Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sa, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Okay, it is nice to be back. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Apologies for the delay. One of my buses got cancelled, and that is why I'm late. But the point is, it is a brand new episode of Take One, and today I have a great episode for all of you. And that is the case because I'm going to keep going through my coverage of the 42nd Vancouver International Film Festival. So, in the past few episodes, you know, the past few weeks, I have been telling you guys about some of the movies that I saw at VIFF, and about some of the interviews that I was able to do at VIFF. Today, we are going to continue with that, and we're going to go first through another interview, and then I'm going to give you guys my review of The Boy and the Heron, the newest film from director Hayao Miyazaki. Of course, Hayao Miyazaki is a legendary director in the world of animation. He is one of the founders of Studio Ghibli. He has directed some of my favorite movies of all time, Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, Howl's Moving Castle, My Neighbor Totoro, The Castle in the Sky. You know, the list goes on and on. I absolutely adore his work, and I was lucky enough to be able to watch his most recent film, The Boy and the Heron, very early, like a couple of months early, here at the 42nd Vancouver International Film Festival. That said, before I give you guys my review of The Boy and the Heron, there is first an interview that I would like you all to listen. And this is a very special interview. It is an interview that I very much loved. And this is an interview that I did with the set designer and the production designer for Barbie. The production designer and the set decorator for Barbie, sorry. You know, they were absolutely great. I love doing this interview. And yeah, I'm rooting for them for the Oscars. I generally think they've got a great chance of winning Best Production Design at this year's Oscars, this year's Academy Awards. But yeah, without further ado, here is my interview with Sarah Greenwood and Katie Spencer, production designer and set decorator for Barbie. And here it is. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of Take One. Today, I am joined by Sarah Greenwood and Katie Spencer, production designer and set decorator, who have worked together in a bunch of different movies. They worked together in movies such as Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes movies, Anna Karenina, the live-action remake of Beauty and the Beast, The Darkest Hour, and most recently, they worked together on a small indie movie. You might have heard of it. A little movie called Barbie. You know, who am I kidding? Barbie took the world by storm back in the summer, and it is currently the highest grossing film of 2023. So the first thing I'll say is, Sarah and Katie, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Lovely to be here.
Yeah. Now, the second thing I'll say is congratulations. I genuinely believe that some of the sets that you guys built for Barbie are some of the greatest movie sets in film history and some of the greatest that I've ever seen. I mean, Barbie's dream house in and of itself is just a set so amazing that it was featured in Architectural Digest. So absolutely incredible that the cast of Fast and Furious would just go chill in the set while they were on break while filming Fast X. How insane is that? And also a set so intricately crafted that fans around the world are just clamoring for it to be turned into a museum or a theme park of some sort. That said, you know, Barbie's Dreamhouse is just one out of the many sets that you guys built for this movie. You guys also build the weird Barbie's house, which is also absolutely incredible. Ken's Mojo Dojo Casa house, of course. The beach, you know, the Barbieland Congress, the beautiful tableaus that the characters travel through when they're going to and from Barbieland, which, just gorgeous. And then, you know, even the Mattel headquarters, which feature, like, a joke that is fully based on set design, you know, when they compare the Mattel headquarters to the FBI or the CIA. Absolutely loved it. So, once again, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I think you definitely watched it.
Yeah.
Oh, I watched it, I rewatched it, and I loved it. Okay, now let's jump right into the question. And before we dive into Barbie Land, let's first start with a more general question. And that question would be, what does it mean to be a production designer and a set decorator?
Well, I'm the production designer, Casey's the set decorator. But interestingly, I think it's more about kind of how we work, particularly, you know, we've worked together for 25 odd years.
I think it's true.
Yeah, about that. Long time. And, you know, it's kind of like we both started in the theatre. and in theatre, the relationship between the designer and the director is an interesting one, and one you can't put a piece of paper in between, because it's so merging. And I think that's maybe the way we approach our work, is it's very, you know, conceptually at the beginning, it's very much about talking about it and about conceiving it and what it's about. And, you know, then once we get into the how and the why and the practicality of it, you know, we maybe take on our more traditional roles. But, you know, I think to begin with, it's very collaborative and very communicative. It's the only way it can work, actually. Otherwise, it's too hard.
Yeah, and in its simplest sense, it's really just taking what's written. You know, we have a thing that, you know, it's like there's a blank space before anything is done. You know, before, you know, literally is taking what's written on the page and putting it into a visual sense, mm-hmm. and then creating it, which is quite hard.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, and interestingly, you know, with this one, I mean, we had the most amazing script from Greta, and a phenomenal script. But, you know, the first draft that we read, it had no scene breaks in it. You know, it was just a stream of consciousness, and it broke the fourth wall. It would talk at you. It would say things like, you know, well, on the first page it said, oh, don't worry, studio executives, don't worry about the fact that this script is 140 pages long, because all the actors are going to speak very fast. You know, so she's going, you know, so you're figuring out something that is not a conventional approach or a conventional script, and what you're going to end up with is not a conventional film. And, you know, I think it is, you know, in the same way as kind of Paul and Pressburger, you know, doesn't have this kind of particular genre. It's a kind of genre-breaking film. It's not, you can't pigeonhole it, you can't classify it. Mm-hmm.
I completely agree. You can't put this Barbie into a box.
And I think that's part of its appeal,
yeah.
You know, because it is sort of cross-genre like that. And an assortment of people, all ranges, have really loved it. Some have not liked it as well, to be fair. Yeah. Some have taken against it.
But I mean, I think as well, interestingly, you say put this Barbie back in the box. The box was quite a kind of symbolic kind of piece of imagery that we worked with a lot. You know, we talked about, you know, to the extent that, you know, it didn't want to be disappointing. And, you know, we go back to Christmases where you get this amazing present. You want this thing, you want this thing, and it's in the box. And you're so excited, you've unwrapped it. It's in the box. You get it out of the box and it's disappointing. Mm. And actually, the thing that this had to be in the conversations with Greta was that this is not a disappointment. It has to be, you know, it has to be better than you ever expected for it, what it would be. You know, it's just better than what you imagine.
So no pressure there.
No.
Really, when we're around the blank table with Greta.
Yeah, literally saying,
it's got to have the feel of the best ever Christmas present.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, it comes out of the box and it's, you know, it's all those things that, you know, we were talking earlier about the whole idea of kind of you give yourselves way in, you give yourself keys, you know, and the whole, one of the things was that it was coming out of this, it was in a hermetically sealed box. It has no air, it has no wind, it has no elements, it has no water, it has no electricity, and it just, there's all these things it doesn't have. So you kind of go, well, what does it have? You know, what are we going to make this film out of? You know, so it was good though. That set the parameters, that once you have the parameters in place, you stick by them, and that's how you start to build up.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Now, I guess let's go into the second question, and that is, I do have to confront you about something, yeah. And that is the case because apparently you two are responsible for the world running out of paint. Apparently, creating the sets for Barbie took up so much pink paint that you guys created a global paint shortage. So my question is, how does it feel to know that your sets created a global paint shortage?
Well, I think once that shortage has been created, I don't think the film wasn't out, so I don't think that many people really wanted pink.
No.
Now, we didn't, you know, there might be another pink shortage now the film's out, but yeah.
No, I think it was, that was, as you say, one of the first interviews we did was with Architectural Digest, and it was a slightly off-the-cuff comment from me about, you know, that we ran out of pink paint. But in fact, what happened was we had difficulty getting enough pink paint to do the set, because up to this point, there isn't a huge demand for that kind of quantity and, you know, density of pink. The company that we, you know, supplies the film industry, a company called Roscoe, who also does all the gels and things like that, They go, what? How many liters of this pink pigment do you want? You know, and it was like, yeah, we did cause a kind of a bit of a shortage because of the demands of the film. But I'm sure there's enough pink paint left.
I think now, yeah. Or maybe they're mixing more now.
I'm pretty sure they are. The demand is up once again. But no, fascinating story. I remember reading the headline before the movie came up and being like,
"Yeah, but it was a true story." Yeah,
oh, that's lovely. Yeah. That makes it even better.
Yeah.
Now, I guess my following question is: what are some of the challenges you faced when designing sets inspired by real life toys? And did you take any creative freedoms when designing these?
I mean, I think as you say, the way we work is always from character, and we interpret a story. We don't like directly reproduce. So there were so many challenges, and you know, we talked earlier about the philosophical questions that you ask yourself on Barbie. It's the hardest, probably one of the hardest ones we've ever done. And that question is really, what is a toy? What makes a toy? You know, and what makes a toy? What is the humanity within the toy? So that was really difficult. And we knew that it was all going to be in camera, but to keep this toyness was hard. And there were a few things. We'd never had a Barbie, never had a Barbie Dreamhouse. We bought one, didn't we, in prep?
Mm.
And for the first time. And through that, we worked out scale and all of that. Sarah had a very strong feel of, you know, this mid-20th century American aesthetic. And the key things from Greta were, it's just got to be beautiful. It's just got to be beautiful. And sometimes you look at these plastic toys and they come out and they're in these very sort of crude and strong colours. Colour was a huge thing. Scale was a huge thing. The absence of things. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, I think we weren't recreating a Mattel toy. You know, the other thing is that you had all the Barbie dream houses throughout the period, you know, and it was kind of what we ended up with was telling our story was for our characters in our film. We are not making a toy. We're not recreating a Mattel toy, you know, so you're kind of hybriding it. You're pulling, you know, all sorts of references from Mattel, but also from, as Katie said, you know, mid-century modern, Slim Aarons, Palm Springs, you know, there's lots of references in there. And what it has to do is it has to feel like a toy, and trying to capture that, what is it that makes it feel like a toy? And it was to do with scale. It was to do with, you know, things like what happens, you know, and this is a great thing that Greta did, you know, when she had the dolls is, you know, in the first question is, are they going to be jointed? Are we going to be, you know, are they going to be seated? No, don't be silly. But you've got to get into her head. But, you know, when she talks about the way that they are, you know, when you see Margot and Ryan and, you know, it's when they go and they go for the kiss and it's like, what do dolls do? What do dolls do when they kiss? You know, is that a question? And it's kind of like, you know, like when he runs down the beach and he hits the wave and he spins in the air, because that's what you do when you're playing with your toy. You just take it and you know, and it's capturing those moments. And it's not, those aren't moments that have to be there every other shot. You know, you just use them very sparingly. And, you know, that's how you create.
And it's like the, you know, Greta, we just do it a couple of times, like the giant hairbrush in the beginning, the toothbrush, you know, and then people will believe. And of course, the amazing thing, Margot steps out of the shoe and her foot is still up.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we just follow her, you know, for the rest of it. And so it's that Grextian suspension of disbelief, really. It's like a theatrical moment.
Mm-hmm. But it's like once everybody finds and understands those way in, you know what you're doing. But it does take, it looks simple now and straightforward and of course, but actually to get to that point is
easy. We even said when we were doing it, said if we in any way get this right, it should look like the simplest thing on earth.
Yeah,
you know, it really should. It shouldn't look complicated.
No, but it was to get to.
Yeah.
I love that. You guys really succeeded in nailing the feel of a toy. And that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, of course, there are many details in the set of Barbie that make the set feel like, you know, the real dream houses that we know and love. There are no stairs. There are hardly any walls. There is no running water. And the pole looks like a giant sticker. So my question is, are there any other minor details that haven't been talked about all that much, or that maybe were cut out of the movie that you guys are particularly proud of?
I think a huge thing, I think it has been spoken about, but and it's imperceptible, is the use of stickers or decals, as you know, we
the American,
never, the American.
We'd never.
Do you call them decals
in
Canada?
Decals?
Decals?
Oh, you don't. You're, yeah.
Well, I'm from Colombia, so there's a translation happening.
So there's one of this one, you know, decals. So decals is a sticker, basically. But we like the word decal because, you know, it feels like it should have its own, you know, department and, you know, all around, a special building and everything. And so the use of decals, like in the fridge, on the car, on the lights, on all over the place, I think that's another imperceptible moment that it makes you feel, oh, you think, oh, I get it. But it's not too distracting. I'll get it for that moment and then move on. So I think the decals work really well.
Yeah. They're also on the palm trees.
They're on the palm trees, yep.
You know, and I think for me, going back to what's in the box, you know, it's like the idea of, you know, that everything was in camera. That was a very important thing for Greta. And this idea of this kind of this perspective, this false perspective and hyperrealism, you know, authentic artificiality, you know, the fact that everything up to the garden wall was three-dimensional. Then over the garden wall, it started to become two-dimensional. Then it went down in scale. And then, you know, you had the mountains and you had the sky. You know, so it's you know, that, you know, so it had this real toy-like quality, but a kind of authenticness about it, which was really very... Once you'd done it, you go, oh, God, yeah, that's obvious, isn't it? But it wasn't.
Yeah, and I kind of like, which people perhaps don't know so much, though, each house had a mailbox that was a different bird, and of course, yes. Stories about Barbie had the flamingo. But in the back of that were all the electric chargers for the cars. So we did shoot it with the car being charged.
Yeah.
Sometimes called the cars were electric. Yeah. I don't think that made it through in the end, but I thought that was quite sweet. That male one side electric charging.
Yeah.
That is fantastic. Okay, I think you already answered my next question, so let's skip right into six. Which is, what would you say are the key differences between Weird Barbie's house and the other Barbie dream houses?
Well, the whole thing about Weird Barbie is that Weird Barbie kind of grew out of being, well, didn't they say that she was the most beautiful Barbie?
She was. She was a, you know.
Still was. Still is.
Still is, you know. Yeah.
So Weird Barbie is the Barbie that everybody's had and played with too much and cut the hair, burnt the hair, stuck nail varnish all over.
We all love Weird
Barbie. Yeah, we all love Weird Barbie. So Weird Barbie for us was, you know, the house is based on a dream house, but it's like it's gone cockeyed, really. So it's kind of, you know, it's gone from being very square and perfect in 90-degree angles and things like that. It's just, there isn't one square angle in it. It's all over the shop. And it's on top of this little hillock, and it's like we refer to it as like the Boo Radley house of Barbie Land. It's kind of like don't look at it, and of course you don't need to be frightened of it, because in fact it's the most beautiful place to be, you know. But it's people's kind of preconceptions of what it was.
And I think another key difference is, you know, that Barbie Margot, every day she gets up, she does the same thing, she throws the covers back. Now with Weird Barbie, she doesn't, you know, she is something in a blender, you know. So the difference for us was the house has evolved as she has evolved into those weird shapes, and also knowing then that it's Kate McKinnon playing it and how to do it, we created this like big, we called it the Pandora's box, which we, you know, made lots of things and we put in, they weren't necessarily scripted, they all went into the box and it all came out, and we shot many things that Kate would take all sorts of things out, and including in the end, I think you see the clacker thing that goes like that, and the snow globe, which has her own house in it. And I think...
And the map that came down.
The map that comes down, the big model of Barbie Land. And I think it's the impromptu nature of Weird Barbie that you can't pigeonhole her, which is very different. So it was much more organic, even though it was still, in essence, a Barbie doll and a Barbie dream house. But yeah.
All the rejected
Barbie.
Yeah. Fascinating. I definitely felt like the German expressionism when I was looking at the set, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and the very slanted angles and the weird angles and all that.
And also you might see a little bit of Psycho House in there as well at the top of the hills.
So. Of course. Yeah. And then like even all the stuff about how handcrafted and artistic Weird Barbie's house is in comparison to all the other dream houses, you know. The dream houses feel very manufactured, very much like a toy, very simple. But then with Weird Barbie, you have splatches of colors and handmade crafted models and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So beautiful work.
And I love her first costume as well.
Yes, that pink baby doll. Yeah, I love that. Mm. Absolutely brilliant. That's Jacqueline, phenomenal costume designer.
Yeah. Okay, my next question is concerning Ken's Mojo Dojo Casa House. And my question is, how did you pick the different elements and the different stuff that would come together to create the interior and the exterior of the Mojo Dojo Casa House?
Well, Ken was a bit of a relief, actually, to get, as you say, we've created everything. And we know that you know, Ken brought, you know, the real world in on his shoot, just sort of like, you know, 25-man tandem or whatever. And, you know, Greta had written that, you know, That really it is, he loves horses. And of course, then you have the Lazy Boy sofas and all of that and the mini fridges. And the big thing, I think, was saying to Greta, are you sure you want to go this ugly? You know, are you sure you want to go this ugly? She said, yeah, I want to go this ugly. It has to. And so, you know, on the sort of narrative journey of the environment, this is going to happen to the dream house. So it was just a lot of fun, really. It was just, and it's the juxtaposition of things against, you know, that there was no black, there was no chrome, there was no TVs like that in Barbie's dream house. And then you could bring all that in, was the fun of it,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And the Hummer.
And the Hummer, yeah.
Yeah.
And what he did to the cars, you
know. Yeah. So it was just, and it was done with no aesthetic to it, you know, there was no, it was stuck on, you know, so it's not,
it did, applied,
it was a, it? Yes, it was, it was, it didn't get dirty, it didn't get like, you know, like, but it just became,
it was like, so he everything was considered still, but yeah. He just would push Barbie's stuff aside and just, here goes my mini fridge,
yeah,
and here goes this, and here goes that, and we've spoken about the beauty that is in all the television showing the same footage. I really like that because I think it's really melancholy.
Yes, I think it's kind of anti-design in a way, and yet there's something very, you know, very beautiful, I think, about the, you know, with all the big TV screens and, you know, there's no walls to put the TVs up on, so you put them on the chimney or you put them in the garden or something like that, and it's just kind of so kind of weirdly coincidental. I quite like that.
It was a lot of fun. I loved what you guys did in this film. That brings me to the next question, which is a question that is not really related that much to, you know, set designing or production designing and set decorating, but I did read an interview where basically Greta Gerwig confirmed that the montage at the end of the movie features the friends and family of the cast and crew. My question is, were some of your friends and family featured in that montage?
No. that was all shot in post in America.
Well, so. gathered in post because it is all existing footage from cast and crew.
Yeah.
But it was to be, in theory, shot, and I just think we were all going, well, when are they ever going to have the time to shoot that? And of course, the correct thing to do was do what she actually did, which was to gather the footage, which is what gives it that really authentic feel.
Fair enough. Okay, that was a quick answer. Let's move right on to question number 9. So question number 9 is, what advice would you give to young creatives around the world who want to pursue careers in production designing and set decorating?
I mean, if they want to get into the business, I think be aware that it's, you know, it's really hard work, you know, and right now we're going through a difficult time because the industry has come to a juddering standstill because of the strikes. So be aware of the ups and downs, work hard, but, you know, be tenacious.
I think it's
a brilliant job.
Yeah, I think it's about kind of, it's almost like saying yes to everything. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, you know, if your friend is making a movie and they say, oh, will you do, and you just do it, you know, and you know, as long as it's safe in every sense of the word, you know, just say yes and go out and you know, you never know where that will lead you to. You never know what experience you're going to have. And, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, in a way, you know, you find the best people that you work with. Like, you know.
I think so. And I think, you know, it's getting into the industry. You can train and train and train and then you get into the industry. So if you find like, okay, I want to work in sound, but, you know, there's an opportunity here to go in as a runner in production, take it, because then you can still get to know the sound department or whatever department you want to be in.
And
people come in and go, sound? I didn't know that job existed. So say yes, get your way in.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And keep, you know, don't be blinkered.
Lovely. Thank you. Now, the last question to wrap all of this up is a more personal question. And my last question will be, you know, out of every movie you've watched, what would you say are your favorite sets? You know, the sets that really inspired you to pursue this careers.
Okay, I've got. I remember as a child watching Dr. Zhivago on TV, and watching the snow dacha, you know, where the, and I just thought that was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. I just thought it was like so magical. Later on, another favorite film of mine would be Woman of Affairs, which is a silent movie with Greta Garbo. I just think that's it's beautiful. And I don't disregard very, very early movies because they were brilliant.
Yeah, and in fact, kind of considered.
The Red Shoes is just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's interesting you talk about Dr. Zhivago. And, we, you know, in virtually every film we do, that reference will always end up on the wall with, but in fact, Anna Karenina, we did that, didn't we, with the snow, it was the train that we made look like.
We
looked at the way that they did that, which were they shot in Spain, that dacha, and they did it with wax.
Yeah.
And so that's how we did the train in Anna Karenina. We did it all, covered it all in wax. And, there's always, reasons.
You always come back to your favourite films. Everybody does.
I mean, for me, it just has to be Ken Adams and the early Bonds. I mean, they are just absolutely stunning. And our homage to him in Barbie, is in Weird Barbie, with the map that comes down.
Yeah.
Right? Because, in is it Dr. No or whatever, it spins and it turns like that and you have this giant map and it explains everything.
It flips the table or whatever.
It flips the table, So we had the one that came out the wall and it explains everything, And it's just like,
I quite like that, Sarah. Ken Adam does Weird Barbie. It's quite good.
Ken Adam does Weird Barbie, Biggest compliment I can pay.
I can't believe I missed that. But you're completely right. Okay, we all got some great movie recommendations for everyone watching this right now. And I'll definitely go home and watch some of these movies.
Yeah.
Anyway, Sarah and Katie, thank you so much for joining us today. This truly means a lot. And thank you all so much for watching. That has been all. Goodbye.
Okay, welcome back. I hope you all enjoyed that interview. That was once again an interview that I did with Sarah Greenwood and Katie Spencer, the production designer and set decorator for Barbie. The biggest movie of 2023, probably, the biggest sensation when it comes to cinema in this year's cinema landscape. So it was an absolute honor to be able to interview Sarah Greenwood and Katie Spencer. I am a big fan of their work. I love what they do. I love doing this interview. I learned a lot. They were very, very kind, humble people. I think the fact that despite the fact that they worked in a movie as big as Barbie, the fact that they were still open to doing an interview with, a show as small as Take One, because, let's call a spade a spade. I love what I do and I love my show, but this is not a big show. So the fact that they were still willing to do an interview with us, it just, that's just a piece of evidence of their humility and their love and their passion for their craft. Sarah and Katie, I don't know if you're listening to this, probably not, but if you are, thank you so much. That interview truly meant a lot. I loved doing it. I loved talking with you guys. I learned so, so much. So once again, thank you so, so much. But that was my interview with Katie Spencer and Sarah Greenwood, production designer and set decorator for Barbie. Now it is time that I give you guys my review of Hayao Miyazaki's newest film, The Boy and the Heron. That said, before I do that, we have to go on a little ad break. So here are the ads. We will be back very soon with my review of The Boy and the Heron, but here are the ads.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siyam, Nisiyam,
Nisiyaya, and the Skakhuya, Talitin, Homasquim, Mustail. Sprouts is a 100% volunteer and student run organization at UBC.
Through the many initiatives, Sprouts aims to make healthy, affordable, and sustainably produced food accessible to everyone on campus. Sprouts is based out of Sprouts Cafe in the basement of the Life Building. With rising food insecurity on campus, they've dedicated practices to making high-quality food and produce available to all through the cafe, community fridge, produce market, and free meal distribution. Learn more about these many initiatives and volunteer opportunities on Instagram at UBC Sprouts.
Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
MRG presents Garrett T. Willie at the Wise Hall, performing his debut album, Same Pain. This 23-year-old from Kingcome Inlet offers the world something it has genuinely been missing for a while, a contemporary take on hardscrabble blues and the purest, rawest rock and roll. Don't miss Garrett T. Willie's show at the Wise Hall on December 2nd, and be sure to catch his in-studio performance and interview on Noise Complaint by CITR 101.9, also on December 2nd.
Welcome back to Take One at CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, that was it for the ad break, and now it is time we jump into my review of Hayao Miyazaki's newest film, The Boy and the Heron. I was lucky enough to watch this movie at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. I actually watched this film on the 7th of October. It was an absolute blast. I loved the experience. Thank you to Viv for, you know, giving us an incredible film festival and bringing some amazing, amazing films here to Vancouver. I love Viv. I absolutely love Viv. I love the film festival. I love the experience. I love the movies that I was able to watch. And The Boy and the Heron was definitely one of the highlights of this year's festival. So without further ado, here is my review of The Boy and the Heron. And here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Take One and my review of Hayao Miyazaki's newest movie, The Boy and the Heron. I will just start by saying that I was beyond excited for this movie. I absolutely adore Hayao Miyazaki. He has directed masterpieces such as Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Howl's Moving Castle, Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, The Wind Rises, Ponyo, Porco Rosso, and many, many, many more. He is an incredible, incredible director. And his newest movie, The Boy and the Heron, just came out. Well, or I saw it at the film festival, and I thought this movie was great. There is a lot of this film that I absolutely adored. That said, towards the end, the movie lost me a little bit. There are some bits that confused me a little bit. But okay, I guess I'll start by talking about the good, or I guess I should say the great, you know, the stuff that really, really worked, the stuff that I loved. And the first thing I have to bring up is the animation. You know, it's kind of a given at this point. A Studio Ghibli film directed by Hayao Miyazaki, of course it's going to have breathtaking animation. And you know, this film is not the exception. The backgrounds are gorgeous. The characters are incredible. The fluidity of motion is just a wonder to behold. It is so freaking great to see a conventionally animated movie, you know, 2D, hand-drawn animation. There's a certain artistry that comes with every single frame of The Boy and the Heron. And I generally think the animation at display in The Boy and the Heron is some of the best animation I've ever seen. In particular, of course, no spoilers. I understand the movie hasn't come out yet, so I won't talk about spoilers. But there are some scenes, you know, there are some flashback scenes where they keep showing a burning hospital. You'll know it when you see it. But every time that they cut back to this flashback of the burning hospital, it was just some of the most gorgeous animation I've ever seen. Now, something else that I also very much loved, and it is also very much a given, is the music. You know, the music of Studio Ghibli films has always been amazing, and that is, you know, partly thanks, in a big part, thanks to one guy called Joe Hisaishi. I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name, but Joe Hisaishi has worked with Hayao Miyazaki in, you know, a bunch of his previous films. His scores are always incredible. They are filled with this, you know, sense of childlike wonder and whimsy and magic and fantasy. But, you know, they can also be sad and melancholic at certain points, but they can also be subtle and simple and minimalist. And yet they're so incredibly powerful. And his score for The Boy and the Heron is another banger. This is yet another home run from Joe Hisaishi. Now, something else that I very much enjoyed about The Boy and the Heron is that this movie is very much a Hayao Miyazaki film. This is very much a Hayao Miyazaki movie stylistically. And what I mean by that is, you know, this movie features a magical world that is very similar to the other magical worlds that Hayao Miyazaki has created in his previous films. These are worlds that are full of wonder, full of whimsy, full of beautiful colors, beautiful vistas, that they, you know, perfectly represent, you know, the Shintoist lifestyle or the Shintoist philosophy that Hayao Miyazaki, you know, very much believes in. The creatures are also very much Hayao Miyazaki creatures. They are creative, they are weird, they are fun, they are colorful, they are beautiful, and they always walk this fine line in between being grotesque and scary, but then also being beautiful and breathtaking and magical. Now, this is also very much a Hayao Miyazaki movie narratively, you know, when we talk about the narrative of the movie, the story of the film. This is yet another Hayao Miyazaki movie where a young kid who is kind of coming of age, he stumbles in upon a magical world, you know, whether it is through a portal, or he finds a tunnel, or he finds a door, or he finds it in the backyard. There are many Hayao Miyazaki movies where young children stumble into magical worlds. You know, Spirited Away and My Neighbor Totoro, I think, are the first two that come to mind, and this is yet another one of those stories. And, you know, the last thing I have to say when I talk about this being very much a Hayao Miyazaki movie is that The Boy and the Heron is very much a Hayao Miyazaki movie thematically. You know, when it comes to the themes, when it comes to the ideas that this movie tackles, this is yet another movie that focuses on exploring letting go, you know, on exploring the idea that life involves change, you know, that change will happen. It is inevitable. And we have to accept it, and we have to live with that, and we have to grow as people. These are themes that Hayao Miyazaki has tackled in many of his movies, and I think he once again furthers those ideas in The Boy and the Heron. So that is another reason why I adore this movie, because it is very much a Hayao Miyazaki film. And, you know, if you're a Hayao Miyazaki fan, what else do you want? You know, I already mentioned this already, but I guess the best way I could put it is I absolutely adored the first half of this film. And some of the things that I love the most about the first half is, you know, the build up to the moment where the child finally stumbles into this magical world. You know, the way more magical elements start popping up, you know, more frequently and more frequently and more frequently until they suddenly explode and, you know, the child is thrust into this adventure, into this magical adventure. All of that build up, 10 out of 10, amazing. Something else that I very much enjoy, and, you know, it comes hand in hand with what I already mentioned, is the introduction of the heron. You know, this movie's called The Boy and the Heron for a reason. The heron is one of the main characters. And I loved the way they introduced this character, because, once again, they very wisely walk the fine line between grotesque and magical, between disgusting and majestic. Something else that I particularly loved about the first half of this movie are the relationships between the child and the heron, the relationship between the child and the father. That was another one that led to some great jokes and some great moments. Then there's also the relationship between the child and a group of cute old ladies that are, like, you know, working there in the manor, in the house where the child is living. And then once the child enters into this magical world, the first couple of situations that the protagonist stumbles into are absolutely amazing, and I absolutely love them. Particularly, there are some moments with pelicans. No spoilers, but you'll know it when you see it. All those moments with pelicans I thought were really great, really thought-provoking, really powerful. And then particularly, there's a beautiful moment with this very cute, round, white, floating creatures. You know, you'll know. I'm sure you've seen them. You know, they're featured in the trailer, and they're featured in some of the promotional material. They're great. I love them. The main scene with these creatures is so charming, so full of whimsy, so Hayao Miyazaki and so typically Studio Ghibli that it just gave me shivers. So yeah, this first couple of situations in the magical world, I ate them up. I absolutely love them. That said, in the second half, once again, the movie loses me slightly. You know, it lost me just a bit. When I say that the second half of this movie kind of confused me, I don't mean like the story. I don't mean like, oh my god, I have no idea what's going on. No. You know, the story's pretty understandable, even though it's like surrealist and weird. The stuff that I didn't really understand is, towards the end, the movie has this moment that are very clearly trying to be like, oh, this is the message. This is the takeaway. This is what you should be learning from this film. Both for the audience and the main character. You know, there are many moments where the child is being taught a lesson. And for me, I guess it wasn't that clear what the lesson was meant to be. You know, I was like, what are we meant to learn from this interaction? What is the takeaway from this? So once again, it might be my fault. Maybe I just didn't understand it. But I guess the best way I could sum it up is, towards the end of the movie, you know, very late in the film, they introduce properly two characters, just out of nowhere. One of these characters is called the Parakeet King, and he kind of acts as this antagonist, at this, you know, antagonistic force in, you know, in the last couple of minutes of the movie. And I don't know, I just felt he came into the film kind of out of nowhere, and then he was doing some stuff, and I was like, why are you doing, what is happening here? And then the second character is the older guy. You know, I won't spoil who he is, I won't tell you who he is, but there is this older guy that you've seen in some of the promotional material, you've seen in the trailers, you've seen in some of the pictures. He's a really cool, interesting character, but then there's a moment towards the end where, like, they're doing something that involves like some building blocks, like some little building blocks. And when I was watching that scene, I was like, what are you saying here? What's the point? What is the takeaway? I don't know. It just felt a bit confusing, and it didn't really come together as good as I would have liked. It might just be because I didn't understand it. Maybe on a second view, everything will gel and everything will make perfect sense. But yeah, the second half is a bit messy, in my opinion. So yeah, those are my thoughts of The Boy and the Heron. In conclusion, I think this is yet another home run for Studio Ghibli. This is another absolutely beautiful movie that, if you're a fan of animation, if you're a fan of Studio Ghibli, if you're a fan of surrealism, and if you're a fan of Hayao Miyazaki, you have to definitely check this one out. It is not a disappointment. Even though the second half lost me a little bit, there is more than enough stuff to make this film worth your time. To sum it all up, what I love the most about this film is just how it tackles this, you know, these big questions, these big philosophical ideas about life, about what it means to be alive, what it means to let go, what it means to accept change, to grow as a person. It tackles all of those ideas in a very whimsical, fantastical, surrealist way. You know, it tackles it in a very Hayao Miyazaki way, and that was absolutely beautiful. To wrap it all up, the last thing I'll say is, in Japan, you know, where this movie was made, in Japan, this film is not actually called The Boy and the Heron. It is called How Do You Live. It is inspired on a book by the same title, How Do You Live. And I honestly think that title, How Do You Live, it is a much better title for what this film actually is than The Boy and the Heron. You know, The Boy and the Heron makes it sound like it's like this, you know, buddy comedy of a child and a heron doing wacky, silly stuff. But that is not really what it is. This is a surrealist, visual, creative, beautiful exploration of what it means to live, which in turn means, you know, what it means to accept change and to grow as a person. So in conclusion, I thought The Boy and the Heron was great. You know, I might give it a bigger score after watching it a second time. Maybe I'll understand some of the things that didn't quite work in a first viewing. But right now, I would give The Boy and the Heron a very solid 8 out of 10, which means I thought this movie was great. And that is it for my review of The Boy and the Heron. Stay tuned for more reviews. Goodbye. Welcome back. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed that review of Hayao Miyazaki's newest film, The Boy and the Heron. It was definitely a great film. It's one that I'm still thinking about. Great movie. And once again, thank you to the Vancouver International Film Festival for bringing such great movies to our city, to Vancouver. Now, before I leave you guys, the show is about to come to an end, but before I leave you guys, I thought I would let you guys listen to a song that I very much love. You know, in this review, the review of The Boy and the Heron, I talked about how much I love Joe Hisaishi, the composer for most Studio Ghibli and Hayao Miyazaki films. I think his music is absolutely gorgeous, absolutely incredible. His score for The Boy and the Heron is amazing. It is yet another banger. But I figured, you know, I talked so much about how much I love this guy and how much I love this work that, you know, maybe I should just play one of his songs or one of my favorite songs composed by him. So that's exactly what I'm going to do. I am now going to play The Merry-Go-Round of Life, which is an original song that he composed for Howl's Moving Castle, which is another Hayao Miyazaki movie. And yeah, I personally think this is one of his best. This is one of the best songs he has ever composed. I love this song. And without further ado, here is the song followed by a short ad break. Sorry about that. Now for real, here is The Merry-Go-Round of Life from Howl's Moving Castle.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Sprouts is a 100% volunteer and student-run organization at UBC. Through the many initiatives, Sprouts aims to make healthy, affordable, and sustainably produced food accessible to everyone on campus. Sprouts is based out of Sprouts Cafe in the basement of the Life Building. With rising food insecurity on campus, they've dedicated practices to making high-quality food and produce available to all through the cafe, community fridge, produce market, and free meal distribution. Learn more about these many initiatives and volunteer opportunities on Instagram at UBC Sprouts.
Hello, hello, welcome back. Okay, first of all, what a gorgeous piece of music. The Merry-Go-Round of Life from Joe Hisaishi, which of course he composed for Hayao Miyazaki's Howl's Moving Castle. I love that song. It gave me shivers just listening to it once again. But okay, that is it for this week's episode of Take One. Thank you all so much for tuning in. I hope you all enjoyed my interview with the production designer and the set decorator for Barbie, Sarah Greenwood and Katie Spencer. And I hope you all also enjoyed my review of Hayao Miyazaki's newest movie, The Boy and the Heron. But that is it for this week's show. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Goodbye.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.